Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Tatiana Deering, a professor of social work and co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College, as well as the former head of Catholic Charities for the Archdiocese of Boston. Her research focuses on social justice in public policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tatiana Deering.
Thanks. It's nice to be with you.
Well, thank you, Tatiana. And how do we, as citizens, journalists, academics, how do we navigate this problem that's arising now with Eric Schneiderman, the Attorney General of New York, who, after the New Yorker magazine did a profile on a number of women, I think four at least, who had revealed that he'd been quite brutal in sort of sexual activities with them. They hadn't come forward for some time, but nevertheless they came forward, and within a couple of hours, he was out. Now, a lot of people, of course, are concerned that he was like Plan B. If Trump fires Mueller, Schneiderman was supposed to pick up the slack. So there are all kinds of political implications. But the long and the short of it is, after Schneiderman and then prior to that, Senator Al Franken, how do you navigate between the public posture of a public servant and their private behavior?
It's a great question, and I think it is the question of the day. I mean, we are riding a social change convulsion in the hashtag MeToo movement now, and I think everyone is scrambling to figure out what the right patterns of behavior and consequence are going to be over the longer term. You know, I think in each one of these cases, Ian, we have to look at what parts are common and what parts are truly specific. So in the case of Eric Schneiderman, for example, he had really been quite out front on issues having to do with hashtag MeToo. You know, part of the Harvey Weinstein company's prosecution, lots of public statements in other public policy areas about the importance of women having control of their bodies, not being victims of violence, et cetera. So there's something quite particular about a man who has made public hay and public statements, especially on the legal front, on this issue, then being so convincingly accused about it. I think that's a little bit different, for example, than the Al Franken case, where not only were the accusations older, but he was not specifically situated. He hadn't specifically situated himself as a public leader in hashtag MeToo. Now, he was also on the front end of it. I'm not sure one could have done that at that time. But I think the context really matters, and it's part of what we've got to sort out here.
So, I mean, obviously in this country, we have an anomaly in terms of public morality or the lack thereof. We have a president, of course, who famously was revealed on videotape boasting about sexually harassing women. And nevertheless, he's the president of the United States. He got elected. And now he's more and more mired in scandal every day with a porn star and their activities being all over the headlines and lawsuits flying around. But at the same time, Donald Trump is going up in the polls, and he'll probably get another boost from the North Korean deal if that happens. And, of course, today he again threw a cat amongst the pigeons by pulling out of the Iran deal. So we have this extraordinary spectacle where you are asking yourself, where is the moral compass in the United States?
I think we are asking that, and I think a piece I would add to the really disheartening laundry list that you just put out there is this confusion over where white evangelicals in the United States stand. As a community that really self-positioned itself in the 90s and in the early 2000s as one of the leading moral voices in the country, I think it's also been striking to see the extent to which white evangelicals publicly have now declared that so many of these moral failings don't matter in pursuit of a very specific conservative, you know, social morals agenda. And I think that's been a really troubling part of this as well. It's incredibly disheartening to see the president of the United States guilty of such moral turpitude with no accountability. And I think that's really the word in this movement right now that we've all got to turn our attention to. What do we expect for accountability? What do we want for accountability? What are our mechanisms for accountability? And if we have institutions that aren't capable of executing accountability in a proper time frame, what new steps do we have to take? You know, part of the challenge is a four-year election cycle is the accountability cycle for an elected official who will not resign out of shame or disgrace. And so it is a long wait until the voters have an opportunity to exercise that accountability when it comes to the president.
And again, I'm speaking with Tiziana Dearing, who is a professor of social work and co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College, as well as the former head of Catholic Charities for the Archdiocese of Boston. Her research focuses on social justice in public policy. But there is accountability. I mean, there's no accountability on the Republican side and on the white evangelical side. But there is accountability on the Democratic side. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who led the charge to oust Senator Al Franken, has also been very quick to condemn Eric Schneiderman, and that I think the Democratic Party, they are not going to alienate the women's vote in this country. So half of our politics seem to have some sense of shame and the other doesn't. But where do we go forward, though, in terms of how do we deal with the pathology of politicians? Because whether they're on the left or the right, Democrat or Republican, so often they fall from grace and we learn all kinds of sort of things about who they really are. Is that something in that world of politics that's a sort of a pathology?
Yeah. You know, I think we're certainly seeing a pattern of disclosures here and accusations that suggest that. And whether we know that to be true, I'm not sure. And here's what I mean by that. Is it that there is something particular about political power? And sexual assault and sexual violence at their heart are about power. This is a well-documented fact. Is there something about political power that particularly lends itself to that behavior? Or is there something about politicians that are drawing out disclosure and accusation in a way that maybe other industries or other professions are not? I'm not sure we know that part, Ian. So as a result, I'm not sure that that means we can know yet if this is unique to politicians. But again, what we do know is that power is corrupting, or it can be. And when you combine that with no transparency and little to no accountability, you really wind up quite easily in a situation where somebody can just abuse power. Add to that a staggering absence of women's voices in the halls of Congress, and it's not at least surprising to me as a woman and as somebody who's been engaged in public leadership in my own career that we might see this kind of phenomenon. You know, I think there are probably a lot of listeners out there who might think that this whole, hey, you want to change, elect women thing is a knee-jerk reaction. But in fact, where you've got more diversity of perspectives, you have more diversity of accountability. And that is going to have to happen here.
But in terms of people coming forward, sometimes after decades, to talk about what happened with a former partner. And let's face it, a lot of relationships, I don't even know what the statistic is, end in bitter acrimony, divorce, or nasty accusations, etc. I mean, I think as for as many relationships that are sustained over the decades, there are probably more relationships that break up. But I think that's a given. So is there any kind of legal mechanism here? You've got Schneiderman saying, in the privacy of intimate relationships, I've engaged in role-playing and other consensual sexual activity. I've not assaulted anyone. I've never engaged in non-consensual sex, which is a line I would not cross. Well, the testimony of the women in the New Yorker article contradicts that rather
adamantly, yes.
Yes. So, you know, on the one hand, there should be some privacy, I suppose. None of us would want our sexual lives exposed to the entire world. But on the other hand, there has to be some sort of, is there a possibility of the rules? I mean, we have the Fourth Amendment, you know, for protect against search and seizure. So we in our Constitution, we have a sense of privacy. But on the other hand, again, you get back to this roiling landscape between public behavior and expectations of public behavior and as opposed to private behavior.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that comes out for me in listening to your question is that we really do, for lack of a better word, have two court systems going on right now. We have the court of public opinion, and then in some cases we actually have the legal courts. And many of the accusations and consequences that it feels like we're seeing play out in the public sphere, right, whether you talk about Eric Schneiderman, or you talk about, you know, the accusations against Tom Brokaw 2 weeks ago. There's a court of public opinion that is moving quite rapidly, and where we have not fully established a set of norms and guidelines, you know, sort of our public opinion laws on this. And I think that's going through right now. Then you've got the question of, did someone break the law? And then there's the burden of evidence to prove it, so you've got to go to court, right? You've got to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that person broke the law and try them. There is a lot of gray area in between, but honestly, I think what we're trying to adjudicate publicly now is the rules of the court of public opinion first, especially for these public leaders, if that makes sense.
Well, it's very hard to see a kind of standard here, because you think about Charlie Rose. There was an awful lot of women that came forward accusing him over many, many years. And Matt Lauer is even more. And it's pretty hard not to assume that the women are correct. Al Franken's a little bit dubious in the sense that the political operative working for Donald Trump, Roger Stone, was the first to say that we're going to come after, or I think he said something like, it's soon going to be Senator Franken's time in the barrel, as he had said earlier about Podesta's emails coming out before they were released by WikiLeaks from the Russian hacking. So, and then, of course, the very popular Prairie Home Companion personality, Garrison Keillor, there was only one woman that accused him, and that was somewhat ambiguous. So how do we write the rules here?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we're going to have to do is be able to have a thoughtful conversation about the continuum of offenses. And again, I am not an attorney. I'm not speaking of this from a legal standpoint, but a public discourse standpoint. Early on in the hashtag MeToo movement, there was very little patience for or oxygen for a conversation about the difference between, for example, behaving like a troglodyte and sexual assault. But as we move further into this movement and as we begin to have an opportunity to really begin to change norms and practices, workplace accountability, public understanding of what is acceptable, et cetera, we're going to have to be able to have a thoughtful and sophisticated conversation about this continuum, where we draw lines of accountability, how severe that accountability has to be, and how we adapt to our changing public and private understanding of acceptable behavior. That is just going to take time, and it's going to take people being adults about this conversation while at the same time being responsive to the pain of people whose victimhood has created real consequences in their own lives.
Well, just in closing, of course, people that are wringing their hands over the idea that Schneiderman's resignation means that there isn't a plan B in terms of the Trump inquiry if Mueller is fired by Trump. One of the people that's being suggested as a possible replacement is Preet Bharara, and you certainly couldn't get anybody better than that. So for those in our audience who are weeping over the fate of the Mueller investigation, I'd say you can save your tears for later. I thank you for joining us, Tiziana Deering. I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you for the invitation.
And again, I've been speaking with Tiziana Deering, who's a professor of social work and co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College, as well as the former head of Catholic Charities for the Archdiocese of Boston. Her research focuses on social justice in public policy. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the author of a brand new book out today, Trump Russia, A Definitive History.